across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the programme this morning, Mike Nesbitt, the Health Minister, in the Nolan studio, talking about health inequality and some of the startling stats around it, and the row over the executive committee meeting that Michelle O'Neill attended continues for yet another day. The DP's Brian Kingston with his, policy officer for the TUV, Sammy Morrison, on this today as well with the Belfast Telegraph, Sam McBride. And so it goes on. Lots of different stories on the biggest show in the country. Hope you enjoy.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Well, when we talk about the health service, and there's barely a week in this programme that we don't, sometimes it's about something that's around the corner that we don't know about. What's going to happen to our mum or dad? What's going to happen to us? And so is there any department up there in the executive which affects us more than the Department of Health? And what are we going to do about it? What are we as a community, as a society, going to do about the excruciatingly bad waiting lists that there are in Northern Ireland? How are we going to improve it? Should we in Northern Ireland be paying more? What's our signalling to the executive around that? There's so many questions, and it's great that we have the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, here in the Nolan studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I want to start with health inequality, because it is startling when you look at people who live in rich areas in Northern Ireland. Men, for example, will live 7 years longer if they live in an affluent area, right?
Mm. Now, the most startling statistic for me is about two women. So we could go to the nearest maternity unit. We could see two women born today who may grow up a mile apart in this city. And remember, this is a first world country, and we are a quarter of the way into the 21st century. And yet still, one will live a healthy life 14.2 years longer than the other one. In other words, one might not start getting sick until they're like 64, but the other one will start getting ill at 50.
That's an incredible statistic.
Why is that acceptable?
But why is it happening?
Well, there's so many factors. So we talk about them as health inequalities, but it's just inequalities. So health interventions, clinical interventions, we reckon will account for about 20% of that. 40% is socioeconomic. 10% is the environment, and the final 30% is behaviours. So we're looking at things like the tobacco and vapes bill, which is coming out of London. We want that to apply here. I've already said I want minimum unit pricing on alcohol, because that affects people in areas of deprivation more than the affluent. You know, this idea of, you know, multi-packs that are really, really cheap, that beer is cheaper than water in the supermarket. This is encouraging people to become unhealthy.
Well, when you start talking to people about, you know, beer's cheaper than water and you want to intervene, that's the nanny state. That's you telling people what they should buy. Shouldn't they have the choice for themselves?
I don't think so, because what they're doing is they're putting pressure on the health service, which is entirely unnecessary. They're damaging their own health, so there has to be a balance there, Stephen, and that's what I'm trying to introduce.
But what is the balance there? When people want to run their own lives and want to go out, and if they want to spend their money on beer or, like me, burgers and chips and crisps and all of that, how much do you think you and the executive should be intervening?
Well, when we come on to talk about waiting lists, then I will say to you, look, one of the reasons that we need to tackle waiting lists is to deal with people who have become unhealthy through behavioural choices. So, you know, what we can do is we can spend more and more, we can ask for more and more money to keep delivering healthcare the way we are delivering it. Or we can do something different, which is about early intervention and preferably prevention. So when Professor Bengoa was here a couple of weeks ago, he sat down with myself and with representatives of the other three parties of the executive, including the two first ministers. And he made clear that if you don't start doing things differently, it won't be that long because until health will require the entire budget of the Northern Ireland Executive. There won't be a penny for schools, there won't be a penny for roads, there won't be a penny to build social housing. And of course, that is the opposite of sustainable. So we have to achieve what is commonly known as shift left. So if you think about home to an acute hospital as a line, the hospital is outright. I want to shift all the resources, as many as possible, to the left. So if you need healthcare, in the ideal world, it's delivered to you in your home. And if it's not at home, as close to it as possible. The second worst option is you have to go to an acute hospital to get your healthcare. And the worst option is you have to go to that acute hospital and stay overnight. And who wants to do that?
When you think of the amount of votes that are driven from working class areas in Northern Ireland, and how much political parties try to connect with that catchment of people, do you think they actually realise that in terms of the statistic you've just quoted, for men it's 12.2 years that someone in an affluent area will live a more healthy life than someone who's not? Do you think the public actually realise this?
I would be surprised, because these statistics actually surprised me when I came into this role. And I came to the role from the Economy Committee, and I was very focused on economic inactivity. And at the moment, I think our rates of economic inactivity are over 28%, well over one in four people of working age. And apart from students who are staying to get higher qualifications, which is a good thing, this is terrible. And when you look at the reasons why people are economically inactive, health is probably, it's certainly top of the list, both physical and mental health. But there's also issues like affordable, accessible childcare. So all these issues are things that are not just down to the Department of Health, they're down to the executive. And tackling those health inequalities, I think, is the ultimate test of whether we as an executive, as a group of ministers, can work collectively. Because we've never shifted that dial on health inequalities. In fact, if anything, it's getting a little bit worse.
You're also leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, so you will be making political decisions within the executive as well, trying to bring other parties with you. And it's about priorities, because we don't have enough money to do everything. We get that. So would you, for example, for a period of time, favour prioritising, blatantly, openly prioritising the people in those areas, the less affluent areas,
well,
with money and resource, and take it away from the richer people?
Well, what I'm doing is not that.
Why not?
I am targeting those areas with an initiative which I'm calling Live Better. And we've identified two demonstration areas, one in West Belfast and one in Derry/Londonderry. And we'll be going into those areas hopefully soon. And what we're going to do, because budgets are so tight, is take existing services, bundle them together, and effectively bombard those areas with those services.
Are you taking services away from other areas?
No, I'm not. No, I'm taking stuff that already exists. And we're going to go into those areas, and we're going to see what the uptake is in terms of those services, which might be screening, it might be vaccinations. They will liaise, and it will be co-produced, I would hope, with the clinicians in those areas. And let's see what the results of those are. And I would hope they are so positive I can take those to the executive and say to ministerial colleagues, we have started this process, which is only 20% health. Let's do the 40% socioeconomic. Let's do the 10% environment. Let's make a real difference and shift that dial for the first time since devolution in 1998.
Let's talk about waiting lists, and let's start with ED waiting times. Accident and emergency, Royal College of Emergency Medicine are warning that we've got to prepare for what could be a disastrous winter. Department of Health statistics, July to September, worst quarter on record. 20% of people waited in ED 12 hours or longer in September. Just last month, the average waiting time, 16 hours.
It's not acceptable. I accept that it has to change, that we're going to have to do something. I have to be honest and acknowledge that a lot of people are working very hard on this, Stephen. And actually, in some ways, the waiting lists are going in the right direction, but far, far too slowly. I put a bid in, or the department put a bid in, for £135 million in the budget to tackle waiting lists. It is our assessment that if you want to do the excess waiting lists, get waiting lists down to where they should be rather than get rid of them altogether, if you want to get them to the target levels, you're going to need £135 million a year for 5 years. That's, what, £675 million pounds, well over half a billion pounds. Now, we didn't get that money in the budget.
How much did you get?
We didn't get anything. So I have allocated up to 76 million this year. But you're scratching at the surface. If we want to get those excess waiting lists tackled, we're going to have to spend money on it. But long term, the way to deal with waiting lists is to get in with prevention and early intervention. That shift left that I've been talking
about.
But
shorter term, and every health minister that's been in this studio has said the same thing, to be honest. It's unacceptable. It's whether you are going to be any different than them. It's whether you're going to have any different impact on them, which is the next person coming in saying it's unacceptable. Well, so what are you specifically over the next 12 months going to do? Let's start off in ED, in an accident and emergency. Like, I've been there recently and you look around you and it's like a war zone some nights.
I have been in several EDs over the last couple of months, Stephen. And yes, it's really, really bad. I was in one where I didn't even get into the ED. I was just in the corridors with a lot of people who were waiting to be seen. And the consultant ED came to me and said, I fear this is the start of winter pressures. Stephen, it was the last week of August.
So what are you going to do about it?
Well, I'm going to continue to ask for money. We're going to continue to look at the long-term solution because short-term, to be realistic, without that 135 million, there's only so much that can be done.
So are we looking towards a disastrous winter for ED now?
Well, I'll address that in one sec because there's another important point about EDs. You know, traditionally, you have an emergency department in an acute hospital. Hospitals are now building something else called critical or urgent care. So if you go to your GP, what normally happens is the GP might say, I'm a bit worried about you. I'm going to send you up to the ED at your local acute hospital where you wait for maybe 16 hours and you're assessed a second time. Do you need to be assessed a second time? Maybe not. So rather than send you to the ED, we're hoping that we will get into a position where GPs will be able to refer you directly to this urgent or critical care unit, which might be beside the ED. And by the time that you get there, the consultant and the staff in that critical care unit are already waiting for you. They've already had a look at your notes and they're ready to process you much more quickly. Sorry, what was the question?
The question was this winter. Can you give us a heads up as to, you must have looked at the planning for this winter and what the expectation is. What are we facing in the context of what the Royal College of Emergency Medicine are saying? What are we facing November, December, January?
So there is a plan. The plan is almost finished and I would expect to be looking at that plan next week. So I'm going to frustrate you by saying I can't give you the exact detail of that. But what we have to do is look at worst case scenarios.
What does that mean?
How bad do we think it can get and what's our plan to deal with it?
Are you worried?
Concerned, yes. Of course I'm concerned.
About what?
About people suffering longer than they need to suffer.
And will it be any different than last year?
I don't know. But there will be a preparedness plan and it is pretty close to completion. And I hope to be looking at it in the coming days.
Does all of this come down to money in the short term? Like, what would money buy you in the short term?
Well, I've said if you gave me £135 million, we would tackle waiting lists.
Immediately, by doing what? What would it buy immediately?
It would buy time, it would buy theatre space. We could bring back in there was a very popular cross-border reimbursement scheme where people were travelling into the Republic of Ireland, getting their treatment there, paying for it, then coming back here, and then we were reimbursing them for the NHS rate for whatever procedure they need. There are several things that we could be doing with that money.
And while we're talking about money, there's been a recommendation that staff in England, Scotland and Wales are given a 5% increase. This is on top of the increase that they've just got. Are you going to give that to your staff here in Northern Ireland?
I would like to give them what they deserve. I would like to give what is recommended by these various pay bodies.
That's 5%, right?
Yeah. And by the way, the Royal College of Nursing, I think, have rejected the 5%. So, look, I'm sitting in a position financially at the moment where we are not currently balancing our books. nor do we think we've got the money in the bank to meet these pay awards. So we are optimistic that more money is coming.
Why?
Barnett Consequentials, the Department of Finance, have made clear that they expect significant money coming out of the Barnett Consequentials, and we would like to think the Department of Health will do well out of that. But you've also got the autumn statement, you've got the budget coming up at the end of the month, and we don't know what's in that. But again, there's a lot of rumour that health in England will do well out of that. That will yield more Barnett Consequentials. Those, of course, won't be ring-fenced. They won't automatically migrate across to my department, but we will certainly be making that argument. So in terms of doing that pay, it's difficult. But there's two pots of money, and I'm not confident we're going to get enough to cover both of them. So one pot of money is the money we need to balance the books. And if we don't balance the books, the finance minister has made very clear that there's a £559 million loan from Treasury, which they're prepared to write off if the executive balances the books. But if I'm responsible for that not happening, and that £559 is taken off next year's executive budget, that's a disaster for us. And against that, if I don't get the pay right, then I'm almost certainly looking at industrial action.
So will you be recommending the 5%, given you've explained the complexity of it and how difficult the decision is, but you've got to make that call.
Yeah.
So will you be recommending the 5% for your workers?
I hope so, but that call can only be made when I know the final financial position for the rest of this year. And that should come, let's say, in the first week of November. That's a couple of weeks away.
Yeah, but that hard choice sits there today. You're never going to have enough money to do everything you want, are you? So you're going to prioritise increase pay for staff over pumping it into other resources in the health service?
There's a plan. But this isn't the place to reveal it.
I'm not asking you for the details of the plan. I'm asking for your messaging to the staff.
Is that I want you to get what these independent bodies are recommending in terms of pay, and I will do my best to meet those recommendations.
You've said a few months ago that this is before you became health minister. No, it was when you became health minister that there are certain cuts that you just will not make.
Catastrophic, yeah.
Catastrophic cuts. How have you got the authority to do that? If you've got a permanent secretary who is supposed to wind you in and not allow you to overspend, and we saw Hugh Wittes doing that with the chief constable who wrote to him and said, you will not overspend or I will intervene. So how have you got the authority to overrule the permanent secretary?
Well, I think I got very lucky, first of all, in getting Peter May as my permanent secretary. He's very experienced. He's got a brain the size of a planet. And I think we're working very well together. So we haven't had any reason to fall out or have a dispute. Ultimately...
But why is you threatening to overspend your budget not a reason for him to fall out with you?
Well, I'm not threatening to overspend it. I'm saying I won't make catastrophic cuts. And what I'm hoping is that...
No matter what?
Yeah, but...
No matter whether it's an overspend or not?
Well, it's not necessarily going to be an overspend, depending on the Barnett Consequentials and the results of the budget at the end of the month. So, look, where we started with the original executive budget was really, really bad. So bad I voted against it. But since then, in June monitoring, we got a very significant sum of money in, which hasn't balanced the books, but it's really helped. And I'm grateful to the Minister for Finance for that. There's a real expectation, there's a reasonable expectation that more money is coming between now and year end.
So are you confident you can balance the budget?
I think we have a plan which may work.
What does that mean?
Well,
that may work, what does it mean? You know what the plan is. Are you confident you'll balance the budget?
I've told you, to balance the budget may put the pay at risk. To do the pay may put balancing the budget at risk. But it depends how much money is coming.
Okay.
So we're going to just go round in circles on this argument.
Okay, so we'll find out when? A couple of weeks' time?
Yeah.
Okay. In terms of, again, things that we're looking at across the water and the government across the water, it was last week this was in the news cycle, talking about giving weight loss drugs to people and that may help the economy and that might be a good thing for the state to do. Do you think the NHS here in Northern Ireland should be doing that?
I think we should be thinking about it. We are talking about an obesity management strategy or service. We've consulted on that, and we're now at that position of analysing the responses to the consultation. So that's something that is in play. I believe the Secretary of State, Wes Streeting, is talking about injections.
Correct.
Haven't gone there yet, Stephen.
Would you contemplate it?
There's a study. There's a good study, I understand, going on in Greater Manchester. That might give me the clinical lead in terms of advice to be positive about it. But let's see how that plays out. I understand there are other medicines, relatively new, which are proving to be both safe and effective. And if they're safe and effective, that's a good thing, yeah.
How much, Mike, do you, Minister, believe people being fat, it's down to their own responsibility?
I'm not sure about that, Stephen.
You need to be as health minister, don't you?
Well, I'm not a clinician, so I don't know how much of that is genetic and how much of that is not. But when we go back to health inequalities, I did say within the 100%, 30% is down to behaviours. But let me put it this way. You know, if you live in an area of deprivation and you're very short of cash, it's very difficult to afford a healthy diet. Vegetables are not cheap. And I think if you look at areas, where are you going to find areas with a high number of quality restaurants? You're not going to find those in areas of deprivation. That's where you're going to find a lot of fast food outlets.
But again, we come back to choices and prioritising and changing how we not just deal with the health service, how we talk about it, right? And maybe tough messaging from you when it's necessary. So you talk about areas with deprivation. You look at someone like me. I'm not in an area of deprivation and I'm really fat and I'm going to have an impact on the NHS at some time in my life. Should your health service be paying for me to get weight loss injections free? Should you be expecting me to look after myself more or not? How much of this is down to personal responsibility?
Well, I said 30% of it is down to behaviours, but those behaviours can be encouraged by the fact that you don't have the money to change your behaviours. You don't have perhaps the health literacy to change.
But what if you do? What about this proportion of our society that is draining a resource from the NHS because they're not looking after themselves?
Well, if I intervene on those basis, if I understand the question, if I intervene on that basis, then that probably is getting into nanny state territory, which is not somewhere where I particularly want to go.
So if there was to be these weight loss drugs, these injections in Northern Ireland, they would be universal. They would be available to everybody that a clinician prescribed them for. Is that what you're saying?
It would have to be clinician-led. So I can't say it would be universally available, but I think a universal assessment would be the ideal position.
You've talked about the wider executive. What's the atmosphere like there at the moment, and how much can you get everybody to sit down around a table and not fight with each other?
Well, I think the atmosphere is good, but I can't compare it to previous executives because this is the first time I've been there. But what I can tell you is when we came back in February, I've been in there since 2011, so what, 13 years? The atmosphere was different. The atmosphere was better. It was more positive. And my analysis of that is that we took devolution right to the brink of ultimate collapse and realised there is no viable alternative to power sharing. You know, this is a little postage stamp on the world map. There are Irish nationalists and republicans, there are British unionists and loyalists, and there are people who want to be described as none of the above. We're all entitled to be here. Nobody's going away. So we need to learn to muddle along together. And everybody knows if Stormont collapses again, it's gone.
There's no chance of it collapsing again, is there?
I don't think there's any chance of it collapsing again. So the mood in Stormont and Parliament Buildings is better. The mood in Stormont Castle, where the executive meet, I think is very good.
Yeah, and you're saying that in a week where we're seeing this continued spat between the DUP and Sinn Féin?
Yeah, but these things happen. And you've got to live not just in the moment. And my concern, by the way, and I think we're kind of forgetting about this, there are victims in this. We don't know who they are, so we don't know how well they're being looked after. And, you know, as a former victims commissioner of the victims and survivors of the conflict, of the Troubles, you know, I'm concerned about these people. The 16-year-old, is that person okay? Is he being well looked after? It's not just about the big political stuff.
So when you looked at both Michelle O'Neill, our First Minister, and Mary Lou McDonald, just a couple of weeks ago blaming the British Heart Foundation for not doing due diligence around Michael McMonagle being employed. How did you feel?
I think mistakes were made, but apologies have been offered. And my concern is, even if you want to de-escalate this row, this dispute, you have to be convinced that there's nothing more to come out of the woodwork. And that's not down to me. That's down to others to convince the rest of us that that's it. There's nothing more.
You described that there is mistakes. There's a difference between a mistake and deliberately not telling the public things. Which do you think the First Minister has been doing?
I am not sure that the First Minister... I don't know how to answer that without creating unnecessary headlines and what I think would be unnecessary headlines, Stephen.
So you're not going to tell the public what you're thinking?
I'm not sure what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that this was a terrible series of events involving a number of people. They've created victims, and I'm thinking about the victims.
You see, the victim gave an interview to the Sunday Independent, and the victim was talking about not being treated properly and about being upset. Which is why I'm asking you, we need candour from our politicians, don't we? I'm just wondering for your evaluation of how our First Minister has behaved.
Well, I think the party got it wrong.
Deliberately or not?
I don't know. I don't know the machinations in there. But, you know, I've been involved in cases, Stephen, where the kind of desire to protect the corporate image has superseded the desire to do the right thing by victims. And there is clearly at least a whiff of that in this case.
Except when you talk about the desire to protect the corporate image, you're the same person who has said in recent times one of the things that you want to change within your own party is not to wash your dirty linen in public. So where do you sit with that? So if there's anything going wrong within the Ulster Unionist Party, are you going to declare it?
No, what I'm talking about is when you're having a little spat internally, you know, where two people are disagreeing, for example, over a policy. That's normal politics. And we seem to be just very bad at being able to deal with that internally, which is what you should be doing. But if you're talking about...
I'm talking about Doug Beattie being driven out of your party as the leader of your party by your party officers. That's not a little spat.
Well, that is a narrative, and there are alternative narratives.
So what's the truth?
That would be to wash the dirty linen in public.
But you've just said there's an alternative narrative.
Yeah.
So...
What you stated as if it was fact, and what I'm saying is I don't think that is fact.
Let me ask a question that is more productive. Do you think the party officers have learnt anything from how Doug Beattie wasn't able to continue to lead your party? Do you think you will have the autonomy and the authority to make the decisions, or is it the men in the background?
Let me answer it like this. When I was elected leader for the second time, I spoke to delegates before they voted, and I am confident that I have the right powers and the right backing to lead the party.
Can I ask you about a live issue just before we go this morning? Smacking. We know that the minister... The Justice Minister is in favour of banning it. Are you?
I had
legislating to ban it?
Yeah, I met with the minister. We had a discussion about this, and I raised two concerns, Stephen. One is enforcement. How do we make sure we can actually enforce this? And I'm very conscious, having been on the policing board, that we legislate as we should do. We bring in new legislation, stalking, for example, and if you go to the police, they'll give you a list of recent legislation which puts additional duties and responsibilities on them in terms of policing this new law. But we don't give them additional resource. We don't give them additional officers to do that. So one concern I had was enforcement. And the second was, how can we be sure that a child might not abuse this law if it became law? So I don't know about you, but there were times when I was growing up when my parents really annoyed me And, you know, you could take a 12-inch ruler and I'd give myself a couple of whacks on the back of the leg and get a nice big red welt up and go to the police and say, Daddy did that to me.
But as a point of principle, do you think it should be illegal to smack a child?
I think it would be desirable that it never happened, but whether that should be enshrined in law is an open question to me, and I haven't consulted with the party yet, and it's the sort of area where I want to bring the party with me.
Should a parent have a right to choose for themselves how they discipline their children, including smacking them?
It depends on you know, you're giving a parent the right to inflict physical punishment on somebody.
That's what smacking is.
Yeah. I'm not comfortable with it, but I'm going to take it to the party and the party will decide. But we've got to consider these practical issues along the way.
And finally, and yeah, I was warned not to say that. How much are you enjoying the job? What will your test be, your open test be, as to whether you've been successful or not?
Well, first of all, I said it was the political honour of a lifetime, and it is. But it's also the political responsibility of a lifetime. As I was coming into the role, I did sit down and say to myself, "What is your legacy going to be? Is it about saving money?" And it's not. And I very quickly came to two definitions. Will I have delivered better outcomes for patients, for service users, for the Northern Ireland population, and for the tens of thousands of wonderful people who deliver healthcare? Will I deliver better outcomes? And if I do, will have I injected a bit more hope into healthcare? And when we get to May 2027, if God spares me and I'm still the minister, people will make that judgment. And I hope they'll make that judgment on those two criteria.
So if you don't get waiting lists down, you've failed?
That's just part of it. It's also about that big shift left. It's about that reform because, as I said, Professor Bengoa has made clear you can't go on like this because you will actually break the executive's bank, not just your own departmental bank.
I missed one question. I'm going to ask it.
Oh, this is finally.
You were on. The news cycle at the moment is talking about Paula Bradshaw chairing that the committee. And whether minutes should have been taken or not, and indeed whether written questions should have been submitted to Michelle O'Neill or not. You were chair of that committee, were you?
For 5 years.
Would you have submitted never. Written questions?
No, would never have done that.
Why not?
Because
is it inappropriate?
I think it's inappropriate. What we did was we would make, well, if the ministers, mostly you got officials from the department, so you knew they were coming to discuss the strategic investment fund or whatever. When the ministers came, no, there were no kind of advanced warning, but they've got special advisors, they've got officials. They can guess pretty much what the committee's going to be interested in. I don't believe I ever moved without consulting the committee first. So there was one occasion when we were having difficulty getting information out of the department, and what we agreed in advance was that I would go and speak to Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness, the then First and Deputy First Minister, because we were considering using our legal powers to compel them to come and appear before us, which is a very serious kind of escalation. So with the agreement of the entire committee, the unanimous agreement, that's the only time I ever spoke outside of the committee room with FM and
so
DFM.
You've never known in your
no.
time of written questions being handled?
I think it is a precedent, and I think it's a very, very bad precedent.
Okay. Mike Nesbitt, thanks very much for coming in this morning. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot. All right. So we're a little bit late for the news. That's all Mike's fault. He just wanted to keep on answering questions. Here it comes at 9:38. Well, that interview with the Health Minister, the last question that I asked Mike Nesbitt was that when he was chairing the Executive Committee, did he ever know of written questions being submitted to a witness? He said no, he did not, nor would he do it. He thinks it's inappropriate. Fresh questions for the Alliance MLA, Paula Bradshaw, this morning over that controversial meeting with the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, hours before Wednesday's Stormont Executive Office Committee meeting, which descended into what many are describing as bedlam. Paula Bradshaw, who's chair of the committee, told me on Wednesday night on Nolan Live that somebody took minutes and she'd be happy to share them.
So this was not a secret meeting. The Permanent Secretary of the Executive Office was there, Mike Clark and others, and it was a very perfunctory meeting. It wasn't a very long meeting, and I reported on it whenever we got to the committee meeting.
Will you show the public the minutes?
Well, I didn't take minutes, and
oh,
I'm sure...
No minutes taken?
Well, there was no reason to take the minutes. Somebody else took the minutes. I was not there to take the minutes.
Did anybody take minutes?
Somebody took minutes.
And there are minutes.
And I am happy to share them once they're produced. There was nothing secretive about it.
Well, Paul Bradshaw also told me on Nolan Live that only two questions were provided in advance to the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill.
Did your committee supply full, some
no,
full questions to Michelle O'Neill? Only two?
Only two questions.
Two full questions?
Yes, but
what were they?
They were about safeguarding.
And why was she given full questions ahead of being scrutinised?
And this was what the clerk had suggested.
No, but you're the chair, so you must understand why.
We discussed it as a committee.
And what was your understanding of why someone is giving a full question before appearing?
Because it was to demonstrate why she would be coming back to answer in her role as Executive Office
Minister. How does that demonstrate anything other than...
No, Stephen, as opposed to party political questions that she does not have to answer to at our committee. So that's what it was about.
But she sat there today saying that she was being asked party political questions.
Yes.
So which written questions did you hand over beforehand? And who wrote the questions?
It wasn't me. Go ahead.
Yep.
Did you?
Yep. Yes, I provided...
Well, you were claiming this morning it was just broad brushstroke. It wasn't.
No, I provided some sample questions in advance, which included references to McMonagle and Niall O'Donnelly.
You provided questions in advance?
Yes, we did, because we had to make the case.
No,
We were asking, yes, at the suggestion of the committee clerk, we were asking the minister to come back 2 weeks after she had already been at committee. So we had to provide a rationale for inviting her back. And the rationale was for how much the story had changed from Sinn Féin in the intervening time, with several U-turns.
And were those questions provided in advance then asked, word for word?
No, they weren't.
No,
because they were provided context of the sort of issues we wanted to raise. And it was said at the time that the committee reserves the right to ask further questions and supplementary questions. But for the First Minister to claim, oh, I wonder why she was there today. Because she knew in advance those were the matters that were going to be raised. So what was the point in her turning up?
Knowing that subject matter would come up.
And then saying, I'm not going to answer anything on that topic.
Well, listening across this, Sam McBride from the Belfast Telegraph. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Steve.
It's not incidental. It's a question of precedent. Has that now been set, that witnesses are entitled to written questions up front when being interrogated by one of our scrutiny committees? Like, it's really important, this. And Mike Nesbitt just sat in the studio a few minutes ago and saying he's never heard of it happening before.
Yes, Stephen. And look, lots of people listening to this will come down on one side or the other based on what they think of Sinn Féin, of Michelle O'Neill, of Michael McMonagle's case, of what she was there to talk about this week. That's a mistake. This isn't really about Michelle O'Neill, frankly. This is about a Stormont system which is failing to hold itself to account. You're meant to have scrutiny committees in the Assembly on a cross-party basis where they can bring in whoever they like, and they've got really broad powers, sit them down and ask them hard questions. And what we saw underneath the bonnet of that system this week is that some people in that system, and it's clear that this was something that the clerk of that Stormont committee, who is totally independent, who's a civil servant, he agreed with this. So there was no kickback, it seems, coming from him. He was sitting there, in fact, actually approving of what Paula Bradshaw was doing at various points. This is a system that seems terrified of just bringing somebody in at the level of the First Minister, the most senior politician we have, and thinks actually if we asked certain questions, that could be destabilising. That was the sense I got. They weren't literally coming out and saying that. They were dressing it up in terms of saying this can't be about party politics. It has to be about her role as First Minister. That sounds fine. But then when people started asking questions which were about her role as First Minister, then there was an intervention that said they can't just be passingly in reference to her role as First Minister. I mean, it's not what we're used to seeing in a functioning democracy anywhere around the world, really. But that is the system that we have here, and that's a massive problem when it comes to health and education and every other area of our politics.
So, has there been an established answer now from the authorities as to whether people are entitled to written questions before walking into a committee?
Well, look, they will not be entitled to them in the sense that there is no legal entitlement to this. Stormont can do whatever the heck it likes. Frankly, it's got very broad powers. Yeah. This is about politics. This yes, is about precedent in terms of the sort of the kind of expectations that a witness might have. But if a committee says no, we're going to treat you very robustly, very aggressively, they can do that. And what one of the really remarkable things
Well, the DUP
things here,
wrote
Stephen,
some of the questions, right? So how could they ever in the future, in anything they're chairing, deny a witness where they're chairing the committee not getting written questions? They wrote the specific questions and gave them to Sinn Féin, according to Brian Kingston.
Look, Stephen, I'm sure that you have been asked before interviews on occasion, as have I, by people in government and by people in PR companies. Can you give us some of the questions you're going to ask?
Some of the broad areas.
Yeah. But any journalist worth their salt would not give questions to somebody before they interview them if it's actually a proper interview. If they're able to face the questions, they face them. If they're not, they don't do the interview. What you saw here was a pretense that this was a robust questioning. I mean, even if these people had been allowed to ask the questions, the person facing the questions knew what lots of them would be. Now, she would have been able to work lots of that out herself, of course, but it really had this sense of going through the motions, of trying to put on a public show. Unfortunately for the people putting on the public show, they couldn't pull it off, because when it came to actually allowing people to ask the pre-prepared questions, at least some of them were pre-prepared, they weren't even allowed to ask them. So, I mean, it became utterly ludicrous. But Stephen, one really important element here is that If there had been a decision here by this committee to do what it really should have done, which is, without fear or favour, bring the First Minister in as the most powerful person in Stormont and say, look, we have questions. There are questions from the public. We're going to ask you them, whatever you think about that. Instead, what happened here was that the reason they sent her the questions was that this was a sort of negotiation. This was the committee going to the First Minister and trying to persuade her civil servants that they should allow her to come. Now, that's remarkable, because if you look at the Northern Ireland Act 1998, Section 44 gives the Stormont Assembly as a whole, and it's then delegated to Stormont committees, sweeping powers. They can require any person. They can require you, me, anybody listening to this, the First Minister, we're all equal in the eyes of this law, to come and give evidence. That's the power they had, and yet here you have them sitting either ignorant of that or not wanting to in any way acknowledge that, and trying to persuade a witness that they should really come. I mean, that's really what this was about. And then having a meeting with the witness beforehand, all of this was about a system that was pretending to scrutinise, but it wasn't at all using its powers to really scrutinise.
And the issue around the minutes, I asked Paula Bradshaw, the chair, on Wednesday night in Nolan Live, were the minutes taken? She said yes. She said she'd be happy for the public to see them. Have you seen the minutes? Are they published, Sam?
No, and look, I mean, there's a separate issue with these minutes, because it now seems very clear that the only minutes that exist of this meeting are those from Michelle O'Neill's office. So she had a civil servant who did take minutes here. We know that civil servants don't always take minutes in very important meetings. That has come out in the COVID inquiry and the RHI inquiry just last week. They were being lashed by the audit office for failing to do basic record keeping. So there was a system here where the scrutiny committee chair was happy for a system which is not known to have good record keeping to be the only part of that meeting which kept a record of the meeting. Now, look, I think that there is every reason to believe that what happened in this meeting is, as Paula Bradshaw said it, that actually they sat down and basically, yes, they were trying to persuade the First Minister that this was reasonable, it was proper, she wasn't going to be pounced upon about something that wasn't relevant, etc. But actually, we only have her word to go on in that. And some people will not trust her because of their party politics, because of other reasons. And that becomes a problem. This system ought to have independence. There ought to be a scrutiny committee which is robust, which is not in any way beholden, even in terms of who has the records of what happens within it.
Well, the Alliance Party say Paula Bradshaw attended the informal meeting with the First Minister, accompanied by the clerk of the committee for the executive office. Other officials in the meeting were there with the First Minister, one of whom took notes. They say, as per section 7.5 of the guidance for ministers in the exercise of their official responsibilities, ministers are responsible for ensuring an official record of all such meetings is made. Paula is happy for any minutes of this meeting to be published. One of the people who was on that committee, Brian Kingston, from the DUP, with us this morning. Morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
And the TUV policy officer, Sammy Morrison. Morning, Sammy.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Well, Brian, you submitted written questions, you wrote them, and you wanted Michelle O'Neill to see them up front. So is that the precedent set now?
No, that would not normally happen. The normal procedure is that ministers come in typically two or three times a year to their committee. It's important to understand the context that the powers lie with the minister. The minister has the power within their department, and the committee is an instrument of the assembly to hold the minister and the department to account and to ask questions, to ask probing questions, and also to engage with the general public and receive information from them. So we have that important scrutiny role. So ministers generally come in two or three times a year. Yesterday, I'm also on Communities Committee, and we had Gordon Lyons in as Communities Minister yesterday, and a range of issues were covered in that meeting. And that's a more normal scrutiny meeting. In terms of the TEO Committee, on the 2nd of October, we had a scheduled appearance from the First Minister and Deputy First Minister. At that stage, the story about McMonagall had only just broken, and I did ask some questions about his attendance at the event in February 2023 in Stormont. And so I did ask some questions to the First Minister about that event and the Junior Minister Riley, who was in attendance. But there was further revelations that week, including Conor Murphy accepting that the Chief Constable had made clear that his suggestion that they couldn't pass on to the British Heart Foundation their knowledge of McMonagall being investigated for child sexual offences, that they could have passed that on.
So you wanted to ask more questions?
So that Friday I asked, the Friday of the week that the First Minister had been in, I asked for her to be recalled. I wrote to the committee chair and all the other members. That came up at our meeting on the 9th of October, and we were, through other questions about that, it was agreed we would get legal advice on whether just the First Minister and Junior Minister Riley could be invited or whether all four ministers needed to attend. And also Sinn Féin members on the committee were questioning the extent of questions that could be asked. We requested that legal advice at our following meeting on the 16th of October, which was held at Ebrington in Londonderry. The legal advice hadn't arrived, and I was aware that the following week, 23rd of this week, would be our last week before being off effectively for half term next week, the recess week, and that the thing would slip back further. So I propose that, never mind our powers to compel the minister to attend, which is a longer process, can we invite the minister to attend, given the number of issues which have arisen since her first attendance and her declared willingness to be open?
I get all that, Brian, you're taking a long time to explain to me, why did you submit written questions? And are you now on any scrutiny committee that you're going to be on in the future? You know, it would be standard practice now, would it not, for someone to say, here, Brian, write the questions down before you ask them. You did it for Michelle. You're going to do it for me.
Yep. So I'm not trying to prolong the thing, but I'm explaining the context. So at that meeting in Ebrington on the 16th of October, we were advised by the committee clerk that in making that request, and to avoid the department, the minister and the department coming back and saying she was there 2 weeks ago, we should make a rationale for why we needed to invite her back and explain what are the issues that hadn't been
answered. You're still not telling me why you've given written questions. We're 6 minutes into this now.
Well, he recommended that we should provide some sample questions to indicate what were the issues that were not answered at her.
How many written questions did you give?
And I put in four questions. It was made clear throughout, and it's in the letter that was sent to the minister or to her representatives, that members observed their scrutiny responsibilities robustly. So this action does not limit members in asking any additional relevant questions.
But you give four written questions, a heads up to Michelle O'Neill as to what she would be asked.
So that she would know what was going to be coming up. One was highlighting... highlighting the responsibility of the department for safeguarding and how her actions and the lack of action by herself and her party had undermined public confidence. One relating to Michael Monagle, one relating to Niall O'Donnelly, and...
Why did she need those written down?
Because she could be under no... she would understand entirely that what matters would be coming up, and so that
so every witness going forward in Stormont, every witness now is entitled to written questions from the DUP members sitting on scrutiny committees. Because if you're doing it for Sinn Féin, well, if you're doing it for Sinn Féin, why would you not do it for everyone else?
Well, in a context where you're inviting somebody back 2 weeks after they had already attended committee, it'd be quite understandable if they wrote back and say, look, I've just been there. Why should I come back again? You have to provide a reason why you're inviting them back.
People are recalled. People have been recalled to RHI inquiry. They've been recalled to other committees in the past. Can I ask the question slightly differently?
The committee, let me just make this point. Yes, the committee can compel people to attend. That is a much longer process. There's an urgency about this matter. So we requested, in order to bring the First Minister back sooner, we said, look, these are the issues that are outstanding that we need to ask in public interest. And
you submitted written questions. We've established that. Four written questions. Can I ask it the other way?
Which did not restrict what we could ask. I didn't actually ask any of those on the day because we were restricted to 5 minutes, I had to drop the first one, setting the context.
Can I ask the question the other way? Will the DUP, can you rule out this morning that your party will now request written questions before your party representatives will appear at
a committee? No, that doesn't happen. Well, for any normal appearance, that doesn't happen. One of a DUP minister, Gordon Lyons, was at the Communities Committee yesterday, and of course there's no written question submitted in advance. That is not normal. But when you're asking ministers, as we were, to come back 2 weeks after they'd been there,
Sammy Morrison,
to prevent them saying, look, I've just been there,
at the end of the day, Sammy, they got Michelle in front of that committee, so maybe it worked.
That is what we had achieved.
No, it didn't work, Stephen, and I think anybody who watched any of the committee knows fine well that it didn't work. Just to be very clear, Timothy Gasson sits on that committee. Timothy Gasson did not submit any questions in advance, and he made very clear to the chair,
Timothy Gasson didn't
to all of the members of that committee and to the clerk, that submitting the questions in advance would be seen as undermining the scrutiny rule of the committee. And I'm disappointed that other members did not follow that sensible advice. However, there are key questions here, and they don't particularly relate to some of those issues. Some of the key questions are really related to the chair, because we had the ridiculous situation where the First Minister, who was a witness before the committee, hosted a meeting with the chair of the committee. The only record of that meeting is held in minutes taken by the witness. There is no committee.
Well, they weren't taken by the witness. They were taken by a civil servant, weren't they?
They were taken by a civil servant working to the witness, Stephen, working to the First Minister. It was not taken by anybody working for the committee. It's like the police taking a witness and saying, well, you make your own notes of this meeting. I'm sure that will be a sufficient record of this. I mean, we have the farcical situation now where you've Alliance people saying, well, we don't need to worry about there not being a committee minute of this because the First Minister's people took a minute of it. Why is there no committee minute of it? And more fundamentally than that, when did the chair of the committee know that the First Minister wanted to have a private meeting?
Well, look, stay there. We'll talk about this for another few minutes after the news at 10 o'clock. Stay there if you can. Right, good morning. Brian Kingston from the DUP staying with us this morning. We're grateful for his time, along with Sammy Morrison, DUP party officer. Good morning again, Sammy.
He wishes he was Sammy Wilson.
Brian. So what questions remain then around this? We are getting some people saying to us, look, when's this going to end? When are we going to go back to normal business?
I think, Stephen, the first questions that need to be raised before we even get the questions that Michelle O'Neill needs to answer are the questions which the chair of this committee and, to an extent, the clerk of the committee need to answer. For example, at the start of the committee meeting on Wednesday, Timothy Gasson raised the point, and he was the only member to raise this point, that the email which had been forwarded to the members of the committee had the date and the timestamp removed from it. That was the email that came out from Michelle O'Neill requesting the meeting with the chair of the committee.
Well, that'll be disclosable under FOI if they don't.
Well, yes, you'd imagine so, and it'll be interesting to see whether it is. But here's the point about that, Stephen: is it the case that the chair or the clerk of the committee received an email from the First Minister, and did that come from the Executive Office? And if it came from the Executive Office, was it signed off by the First Minister? Because nothing should happen in that office unless it signed off by the Deputy First Minister. Because nothing should happen in that office unless it's signed off by the Deputy First Minister. And when did that email go to the Chair of the Committee and to the Clerk of the Committee? And here's the point about that, Stephen. It's important. Because the membership of the committee were advised at 9:50 that the chair of the committee was meeting with the First Minister at 10 o'clock. Did the chair and or the clerk of the committee hold that information back from committee members so that there was a minimum amount of time for them to object? Now, Timothy Gaston objected to that taking place.
Well, the clerk of that committee isn't here to answer for themselves. Paula has given an interview, but you need to be very respectful here to the clerk, where we cannot be making presumptions based on you just making it up in your head.
We're not just making presumptions on it. We can say, because we know, that the date and the timestamp on the email sent by the First Minister which ended up with the chair of the committee have been removed.
Well, surely there is an easy way around this, Brian Kingston. Emma Little-Pengelly is the Deputy First Minister. This letter was sent from her joint office. She can ask to see the email. She can ask to see the date, and the DUP can make it public, right? Well, Emma Little-Pengelly can make it public.
Well, she can certainly ask that question. I'm not sure who the email was sent by.
Well, hold on a minute. If a message is being sent from within the executive office to the committee for the executive, then how on earth can Emma Little-Pengelly, the Deputy First Minister, how would she not be entitled to see an email sent from her office?
Yes, but I know Emma did put out a tweet or whatever you call it now, an X, whatever email had been sent out by Michelle or on her behalf was not a joint email, that Michelle attended this meeting on her own and made the arrangements on her own. She also arranged the meeting with the committee chair on her own.
But that doesn't add up. Here's why that doesn't add up. Hold on, Sammy. Here's Brian why that doesn't add up. Michelle O'Neill sat in that committee meeting and her fundamental point was, unless it was a question about executive office business, she wasn't answering it.
Well, that was absolutely our frustration. And that's why I made the point that we had submitted some sample questions in advance so she would be under no illusions about what would be raised. You know.
So I think the First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, needs to make it clear. Did she see this email? Was it issued officially through your departmental channels? And when was it issued? Because the chair of the committee deemed fit to forward that to committee members 10 minutes before the meeting started. So did the chair of the committee sit on that email potentially from, 7 o'clock the night before?
Sammy, I've literally just had a 35-minute interview with the health minister talking about people in communities with deprivation not having good health 14 years shorter than people with money. We're talking about people sitting in A&Es for 16 hours. We're talking about excruciating waiting lists. Should you move on from all of this?
No, we shouldn't move on. And
why not? Why not get back into solving critical issues for this community?
Here's why we shouldn't move on, Stephen, from this issue, because this is a critical issue relating to a particular issue that actually touches upon Mr. Nesbitt's department, which is child safeguarding. For example, we had a situation where Michael McMonagle, a self-confessed paedophile, had a active assembly pass and had access to assembly buildings while you had school children visiting there and other school groups, and that pass was active up until 3 weeks ago. That was never cancelled. That is an issue which particularly touches upon the issues under which Mr. Nesbitt has departmental remit. So it's fundamental. And if a committee gets to the point where we are going to have pre-meetings between committee witnesses and the chair of committees, and we have a situation where questions to witnesses are submitted in advance of the meeting, then no one can have confidence in Stormont's ability to oversee health or the roads or anything, because a scrutiny committee, which cannot scrutinise and has a committee chair who is prepared to fundamentally undermine her authority as an independent person by attending a meeting at which the only minute taker is a minute taker under the direction of the witness, and the only advises the committee members of that 10 minutes before the meeting takes place, so has no authority or clearance from the committee to be there, then that calls into question Stormont's ability to do anything. It is fundamentally, Stephen, dysfunctional. And if Stormont...
Well, your party spent a long time saying everything in Stormont is dysfunctional, and the parties, executive would cite dysfunctionality from the TUV. Meanwhile, there are decisions that need to be made in this country. Brian Kingston, do you want to reply to this?
Yes. Well, I've said to Sammy's colleague Timothy Gasson, even though he likes to complain about the Assembly and doesn't have a good word to say about it, he does seem to enjoy being there. Regarding the correspondence from the First Minister, I'm sure, Stephen, you've seen Emma Little-Pengelly's tweet that she put out on the day of the meeting, where she made clear that the correspondence relating to the First Minister's committee appearance is entirely a matter between the First Minister and the committee.
Emma might be saying that, but is that possible? If there is the First Minister there on behalf of the executive office, she was there representing TEO. So Emma can say what she likes, but she can't withdraw the rules and the shapes and the protocols of this country, can she? Michelle O'Neill was there being asked questions in her part of the executive office. Now, what would the problem be, Emma Little-Pengelly, requesting that email that was sent from her department?
Yeah, well, it was left up to the office who would attend, and that was the decision that they came to. The questions were all for the First Minister. And that's why
Stephen,
my concern was about the policing of the questions. I'm in no doubt the First Minister's reason for seeking that meeting in advance with the chair of the committee, Reliance Chair Paula Shaw, was to try and put pressure on her to police the questions because of the legal advice which the minister...
Your questions didn't need police. You wrote them down and sent them in to her.
Well, we sent sample questions, which, and as I told you, I was asking different questions because of the time pressure. I was trying to get to the pertinent points. But the problem was the First Minister expecting the committee chair to police questions. And at the start of the meeting, the committee chair wasn't doing that. But during the meeting, then she did start to do that. And she shouldn't have, because at our pre-meetings, we had made clear that committee members would be able to ask whatever questions they wished of the First Minister. It'd be up to the First Minister whether or not she chose to answer them. In actuality, she basically blanked virtually every question and left us wondering what was the point of her attending at all.
I am going to link you both finally into the opening conversation I had today with the Health Minister. You're two parties who very much attempt to connect with working class people. Mike Nesbitt telling us today that females in affluent areas of Northern Ireland will have good health 14.2 years longer than a female in a working class area. For men, it's 12.2 years. Better health, good health, not suffering ill health as much as poorer people, 14 years of better health. In terms of life expectancy, males live 7 years longer if they're living in rich areas of Northern Ireland. Women live nearly 5 years longer. So, question to you, Brian Kingston. What are we going to do about this?
Yeah, well, this is long recognised as a problem, that the National Health Service, with waiting lists growing, that it does need more resources, but it needs reform. And The health minister has highlighted from Bengoa that just the growing extent of the costs of health. So, of course, and we will continue to campaign for more money in the block grant for Northern Ireland and to be able to allocate more to health. But we also do need to make reform. We do need to have specialisms, and they can't be everywhere. So we need to have the right specialism, and there's difficult decisions to be made around that. But there is an issue around, as you rightly say, around levels of income and people's health and life expectancy. And there needs to be action also at local community level, working through volunteering community groups, promoting health messages, and ensuring that there is uptake and availability of services,
and Sammy,
for everyone equally.
Sammy, you're the policy officer for the TUV. Is there any policy suggestions from your party as to what will help working class people live longer?
One of the key issues that Stormont has failed to deliver on is getting Northern Ireland a fair share of the funding, Stephen, in relation to health. We had, a number of years ago, the Welsh Government commissioned a report by Professor Hockham. Professor Hockham was able to build the case and to demonstrate that Wales needed to be funded to its level of need and that the Barnett Fund formula was outdated. He was able to present that case. The Welsh Government made that case to the Westminster Government a number of years ago and successfully made it. And as a result of that, Wales has got an uplift in their funding allocation from Westminster, which has helped towards the waiting list, and helped towards the health situation there. Northern Ireland hasn't made that case. And even though we had situations where the major parties were all in negotiations with the government and they were talking about this financial package and that financial package, what they were getting at best was a lump sum of money rather than looking at what the Welsh government had done, making the case which, with the paperwork that was already there produced by Professor Hockham, and saying, look, the funding formula for Northern Ireland is out of
date. Well, they have made that case, of course, and the point is they were in there making that case. You were sitting outside.
No, they weren't making that case.
They were.
Let me interrupt. Let me make clear what I'm saying there, Stephen. What I'm saying is they shouldn't have been making the case to say, give us a big block of money. What they should have been making the case was to make a sustainable argument for a long-term, better funding settlement for Northern Ireland. And my point to you, Stephen, is that paperwork's already done and it's sitting on the shelf because Professor Hockham has done that research.
Sammy, thank you very much. Bran, thank you as well. Morning to you both. Harry's in Dundonald. Morning, Harry.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Stephen, what I put this to you, it'd be great if you're going for a very important interview for a job and someone gives you the list of the questions you're going to be asked. How ridiculous was that meeting, a committee meeting, a scrutiny committee meeting, and she wanted to know what they were going to ask her? It's totally ridiculous, Stephen. I bet you didn't know the questions you were asked when you were putting for the job. You're in that.
Yeah, I didn't get a board.
Well, how did you get your job then?
I have no idea. It's that long ago. 25 years ago, 30 years ago. Don't know. I went for a traffic and travel job once, and the BBC told me I didn't have a voice for radio. But they told me that before I went for the traffic and travel job. Then I went for the board, and I didn't get the board. So, you know.
Stephen, the best thing about you is...
Yes.
Excuse me. The best thing about Stephen Nolan is Stephen Nolan tells the people the way it is.
Yeah.
There are no airs and graces. You get it straight from the heart.
Well, I should be slightly fairer to the BBC. It wasn't the BBC told me I didn't have the voice of radio. Somebody in the BBC told me that. That's a more accurate way of doing it. Before I get a complaint from the BBC to the BBC Complaints Department, that would be an interesting one, wouldn't it?
But Stephen, wouldn't it be good if you go in for an interview and somebody tells you what you're going to be asked? That's totally ridiculous.
Why did Michelle O'Neill want to know? She wanted to know the broad brushstrokes, possibly, so that she could...
Exactly.
Well, is that, or did she want the detailed questions? Brian Kingston said he gave her sample questions.
She didn't answer very much on your programme, Stephen. She didn't answer very many questions at all.
This is Paula Bradshaw you're talking about, the chair of the committee.
No, the chair was, I thought, it was a mix-up on who was the chair, because I thought at times it was the First Minister. You know?
Harry, thank you very much. Have you been listening to us for long?
Oh, every time. I was on your programme physically with you. Last year.
Have you heard about the listening figures?
No, I haven't, Stephen.
We're the biggest show in the country yet again, Harry. Number one.
But you are, Stephen.
Number one.
Keep it up, Stephen. Keep it up.
And we want to just say thank you to everyone. And here's a little snapshot of what makes us the biggest show in the country. Is it big?
It is big. One more time.
We've been together for decades now, and once again, for the 20th year in a row, you've made the Nolan Show the biggest show in the country.
We need full truth and full accountability from the outset on this, Stephen.
The listening figures have just been released, and 9 a.m. here on the Nolan Show is the biggest place in radio anywhere in Northern Ireland. One more time, I'm gonna celebrate.
Stephen, that's nothing new, but again,
that's a change.
It's not a place.
I get the blame for everything. It's a wonder I'm not getting blamed for the portrait.
Yeah,
Stephen.
Yes, Peter.
That sounds like a dictatorship.
That's what it sounds like to you, does it?
I suggest you look up American television.
Look up American television.
What do you want me to watch? Quincy. Can't stop. We're going to celebrate.
One more time. You know, it's chronic gridlock every day.
Now, how do you feel about this?
It is a disgrace.
If he hadn't been so cheeky, Councillor Whitey, he might have got an invite to come with me.
Would you have been the last person that I would want to go with?
No, you be careful. Hey, just feeling.
Music's got me feeling the need. What say ye about this? What's going on?
Stephen, as a taxi driver...
What'd you put him on for?
What?
Sorry, Robert, carry on.
Well, when I was a boy and the Beatles wrote a famous song called Taxman, the top rate of tax for fat cats like you was 95%. Would you believe that?
I'm getting prickly heat thinking about this. Celebrate and dance so free. One more time. Music's got me feeling so free. We're gonna
celebrate. Celebrate and dance so free. One more time. It doesn't sound as if he's working anyway.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're working.
I'm not.
To be honest with you, you know, and you can all laugh if you like, but I'm looking up the definition of putative.
See, if he can't do the job, let somebody else do it then.
In the Southwest, they have horse equine studies.
Horse equine studies?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I have a human right to choose how I live my life.
Each to their own. Time to get the feelings free. We're gonna
celebrate and dance so free. And from all of us here at the Nolan team, it is thank you once again. Thank you, thank you, thank you. One more time.
Well, put that mix of the fun that we have, the humour that we have, the connection that we have with each other, the hard stories, the soft stories that we do, and this programme... For some reason, it works, and it works big time with you. So thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Those listening figure assessments come out every 3 months. And for you to put this show number one in the country means an awful lot. Thank you. Keep bringing your stories to the programme. Nolan@bbc.co.uk. Shan, morning, Shan.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And you're having problems with your water.
Oh, no, well, not so much me, but Stephen, myself and my husband opened a fabulous little restaurant in Carrickfergus back at the beginning of May. It's called Luna, and we have been going from strength to strength since we opened. It's great. But we have hit a bit of a difficult spot there since the middle of September when Northern Ireland Water started digging up the streets outside our restaurant. And the long and short of it is they are pretty much closing us down at this point, Stephen. They've cut our takings in half with their work since they started. The
My
noise
goodness.
Is unbearable. I mean, unbearable. Like, we've customers walking in the door and turning on their heel and walking out again because you couldn't sit and have something to eat with that noise. Now, we fully appreciate the work needs to be done. However, when it's bankrupting us, it becomes a bit more of a problem. Now, last week, the week before last, my husband, Neil, had actually contacted NI Water to say, look, we're going to need a bit of compensation here because I can't pay my bills. You've cut my takings so much. To which they replied that they don't pay any compensation for any economic loss as a result of their work. So basically, if you fall and break your leg, our understanding is that they will compensate you, but if your business loses money or, worse still, faces bankruptcy, they only offer an apology, which doesn't really seem fair. So last week, we actually went to the CEO, Sarah Venning, of NI Water, and the senior leadership team, and also after that contacted Joe Austin, the head of the board, the chair of the board, should I say, and basically, we're very sorry for your situation. It wasn't our intention. All we can do is offer an apology.
Well, Sarah, saying sorry is not going to pay your bills and it's not going to keep your business afloat. So, look.
Well, exactly. Today, we're supposed to pay our staff, our rent, our suppliers. We can't pay any of those. We've got a payroll of 10 people who are about to lose their jobs. And this is no joke. We are like right to the wire here. NI Water, a public body, say that they are not funded to compensate for loss of.
So what they do is they roll up to outside your shop.
Uh-huh.
They're installing a new storm sewer on Castle Street.
Uh-huh.
They say uh-huh. that they only did this work after liaison with local business.
Well, liaison was a letter sent out on the 2nd of September, 2 weeks before work started.
That's not what that statement suggests. Following liaison.
No, there was no liaison.
Well, we'll go back to them and check that. Like, what does that mean to the public? Following liaison with local business, it means you're talking to local business, you're sitting down, you're meeting with them, you're planning, you're seeing how you can mitigate the impact on business.
No. And the worst thing is as well, this work appears to be now running 6 weeks behind, at least 6 weeks behind schedule, as per the letter we received on the 2nd
well,
of September.
They've told us
they're supposed to be finished outside on North Street today.
They've told us in a statement the section of works being undertaken directly outside Luna is due to be completed and the area reinstated by Friday the 25th of October, today.
Well, if you were to look at our CCTV footage, they're still laying the pavement again over the big hole that they've dug with their excavator, pneumatic drill, whatever you call it. Like, it got to the point last Thursday and Friday, Stephen, we actually had to close our restaurant during the day until 4 o'clock. So we lost 2 full days trade due to the barriers being right up at our window. So you couldn't even see in or out of the restaurant. We have sent them recordings of the noise. We have CCTV footage of customers literally walking in and out of the restaurant again. Like, we have invested everything we have bringing, like, our restaurant is number one on TripAdvisor in Carrickfergus. And actually this week we reached number one in County Antrim. And yet we're going out of business entirely because of NI Water, and they're not taking any responsibility. And it's horrifying that a public body is willing to let a small business go under.
So have they not?
Sorry about that.
This is Minister John O'Dowd's department. This is the Department of Infrastructure. They say a new storm surface water sewer schedule will be completed in mm-hmm. January 2025. So yes. having told the chair of, who did you tell? Sarah Venning, the head of NI Water?
Sarah Venning is the CEO of NI Water, and then Joe Austin is the chair of the board.
And so having told them, look, this business is going to go kaput. The result of that's 10 people losing their jobs. Have they offered to meet you? Have NI Water sat down and said, what can we do here?
No, they have done absolutely nothing. They say as a public body, they're not funded to pay compensation for any economic loss. So that came from Sarah Venning last Friday after we emailed on Wednesday the 16th and got no response. And then I emailed on Friday to say that I was concerned that we hadn't even had an acknowledgement. And I got an email back from an Alistair Jinks, who's on the SLT, I believe, in NI Water, to assure me that the matter had been escalated, the appropriate people were dealing with it, and I should expect a response.
Is there noise there this morning?
Oh, yeah. Sure, yesterday. Yesterday, there was no digging from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. We usually open at 10. So we had to postpone opening till 12 o'clock to try and get some footfall. Yeah. And they started digging again at 12 o'clock, which is the lunchtime period.
So,
and when I say digging, Stephen, you couldn't listen to it. It's horrendous.
We'll send a crew up next week.
And the telly show's off, but there's a 250,000 people following me on Twitter. So we'll send someone up, we'll gather what's happening. And this goes to ministerial level now. This goes to John O'Dowd now in Sinn Féin. Your party purports to represent working class people. Here's a couple of entrepreneurs employing 10 people, and they're being driven out of business. Is there nothing can be done? We'll pick this up again next week, Sian. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. It's Vinny and Kit. Oh! Standing in for Connor this morning. Ho-ho! Listen again. Here we go.
BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.